The first case of the day is 031322, the United States of America versus Sedgwick Johnson et al. Good morning.
Hey, please, the court. My name is Joseph Franklin, and I'm here today on behalf of Sedgwick Johnson. We raised a number of issues in the briefs, including arguments under Federal Rule of Evidence 403, some arguments concerning statements made during closing arguments by the prosecutor, some sentencing issues. I'm going to focus today on the Rule 704B issues that we raised. And at trial, the government called Agent Robert Coleman to testify as a law enforcement expert. And I think one issue that's not contested here, as I understand it, the government's brief, trial counsel timely raised objections at trial under Rule 704B to Agent Coleman's testimony. So that if we do convince the court that there was a Rule 704B violation, Federal Rule of Criminal Procedure 52A applies, and the burden is going to shift to the government to demonstrate that the error was harmless.
You know, Mr. Franklin, Mr. Coleman appeared to have confined his testimony about what the typical drug courier in his experience knows and understands. Why would that be a violation of 704B?
Well, the Seventh Circuit has stated, for instance, in United States versus Lipscomb, that's at 14F 3rd 1242, the testimony must be, quote, based on the expert's knowledge of common criminal practices and not on some special knowledge of the defendant's mental processes. Relevant in this regard, though not determinative, is the degree to which the expert refers specifically to the intent of the defendant.
Well, it's true that the government wanted the jury to infer that Mr. Johnson's knowledge was no different than the typical drug courier that Mr. Coleman was describing. But Mr. Coleman never purported to look into Mr. Johnson's mind, did he?
Well, I think what he did not do, admittedly, is directly state that defendant Sedgwick Johnson had the intent or had the knowledge. Okay, but that's not dispositive under the Lipscomb case. That case says that it's relevant, though not determinative, that the law enforcement agent doesn't refer directly to the intent of the defendant. Okay? I think what the Seventh Circuit cases say is that a law enforcement expert is allowed to come in and testify as to the objective facts and circumstances surrounding the typical drug transaction. And then the jury is allowed to make whatever inference it's going to make based on those objective facts and circumstances. What the Seventh Circuit has never allowed is for a drug enforcement officer to come in and testify directly concerning mental state, knowledge, intent, awareness, etc.
So let me just stop you for a minute. What are the exact words that you say Coleman used saying he had that direct knowledge?
Okay, there are a number of examples.
Because I've looked at the briefs and that, you know, those statements I don't think really directly say that. I guess I'm asking, is there anything more than what you said in the brief?
There isn't anything more, but I think what we say in the brief points out that Agent Coleman wasn't in the realm of objective facts and circumstances that surround a typical transaction. He was in the realm of a person who transports narcotics always knows the nature of the transaction he's engaging in. Okay, a person who transports narcotics always is aware of what he or she is doing, the only exception being children. That testimony directly addresses mental state. It directly addresses a mental state that's an element of the offense charged. It's not testimony.
It doesn't address Johnson's mental state, does it?
Well, yes, it does. Okay, he did not say directly that Johnson has the mental state. But clearly, if you're stating that everyone always knows the nature of the transaction, you're
not
saying...
Not everyone. The typical courier.
I'm sorry?
The typical courier. He didn't say...
Well, but the Seventh Circuit has said that you have to, the testimony has to relate to common criminal practices, okay? And the Seventh Circuit has said that again more recently in United States versus Love.
But isn't that what the word typical means? I mean, typical translates, at least in my mind, to common.
Okay, I agree with the typicality of it, okay? But the typicality has to relate to objective facts and circumstances, like how the drugs were packaged, whether the individuals were carrying beepers or cell phones or weapons, okay? An expert can paint a picture of the typical facts and circumstances, but to go on the stand and say that a person who's carrying narcotics always knows what he or she is doing, that's not permissible under Rule 704B, and that's clearly a statement as to the intent or knowledge or mental processes of the defendant.
Now, of course, there also was a cautionary instruction, wasn't there, by the court?
There was a cautionary instruction, and we've briefed that issue, and the court, in spite of the cautionary instruction, you still have to look at the underlying testimony and make a determination as to whether the jury was swayed by the impermissible testimony.
See, the problem I think you have is you want us to really draw the inference that really, since he said the typical courier always does that, then the next piece would be, therefore, your client had to be his state of mind. And that is sort of an inference you want us to draw. And certainly, the way I look at the cautionary instruction, the court gave the jury a way in which to evaluate that testimony by the agent, by Holden.
All right, well, there is persuasive authority from the Fifth Circuit that I've cited that says that when you do give this type of testimony, so-and-so always knows what he or she is doing.
You're talking about the mental state of the person who entrusts the drugs to the courier, aren't you? Isn't he saying that person is not going to entrust them to somebody who isn't aware that they're drugs?
And that's
what
I'm saying.
That seems to me to be perfectly acceptable. Why can't
But the Fifth Circuit has said that that's not acceptable.
Why isn't it?
It's not acceptable because when you say that the person who's carrying the drugs always has to be aware, you are in effect saying that the defendant was aware. You're speaking directly to that person's mental intent, knowledge, and awareness. Thanks.
Mr. Turner.
Good morning. My name is Philip Turner, and I represent Kalonji McMillan on this appeal. The issue we've raised, and I only have 1 minute of the 15 minutes allotted for us, is that to the heart of this is that the evidence was insufficient. Now, obviously, the case law in this court has been that it's basically impossible for a defendant to have his conviction overturned. But in this case, I think to affirm Mr. McMillan's conviction would be unjust, irrational, and dangerous.
Why wouldn't the phone calls between Mr. Cooper and Mr. Rauner, coupled with the fingerprint, be enough to convict Mr. McMillan of conspiracy?
One, because the phone calls never show that Mr. McMillan is on the phone. There are calls to a phone, as they said, associated with. There's nothing about Mr. McMillan ever being on that phone. And obviously, I could call your phone and your number, and I don't know who might be answering the phone. The other thing is the fingerprint, and I think I addressed it with some case law in my brief, but a fingerprint could have been put there any time that Mr. McMillan was at his brother's house. It's meaningless. It has, if you look at it rationally, it wouldn't be a rational basis for a conviction, to answer your question directly. So those things are meaningless, absolutely meaningless. The only thing here is that at one time Mr. McMillan is seen in the location. Other than that, there is absolutely nothing. Plus, as I indicated in the brief, the evidence is contrary to the laws of nature and to the government's own expert who testified about how long it would take to cook up this cocaine into crack. So that's why, as I say, it would be just unfair and irrational. Plus, it would be dangerous because what it says is, if I say that you were involved in a bank robbery with me, and I just happen to come up here and meet with you, and I make all kinds of statements to somebody, and they record those statements, that would mean you could be indicted and on trial and possibly convicted in front of a jury. And it's just a dangerous thing. The government cites one case where they say that this was, it's okay. But in that case, if you look at the facts, it's clearly different. It's where a person testified and was subject to cross-examination. The statements that inculpate Mr. McMillan are by Mr. Cooper, who supposedly co-conspirator never testified.
Thank you. Okay. Mr. Sannon?
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Nishay Sen, and I represent Raymond Cooper. There is a number of issues that we raised on this appeal, but I want to focus on one without waiving other ones. But bringing to your court's attention, we did raise ineffective assistance of counsel in our initial brief. We're going to ask to withdraw that, because the reason we waived at the time the initial brief was due.
That was going to be my first question to you, because
the law changed a little bit since we filed our initial brief. Initially, it said if new counsel came in, there was a Second Circuit case said that the new counsel, if they didn't waive ineffective assistance, the counsel would waive it. Since that time, there's been case law that says, well, no, that's not right. It's changed. So for that reason, we'd withdraw that argument and save that for a 2255 issue.
Even under the old law, I must say that if we reached that claim on this round, he wouldn't be able to pursue it later in a Section 2255 proceeding.
That's correct.
So, okay.
So waiving that issue, Judge, but not waiving any of the other ones, I'd like to address in front of the Seventh Circuit the issue of sentencing entrapment. I acknowledge that the Seventh Circuit doesn't recognize sentencing entrapment, but I think it's a time for the Seventh Circuit to look at it again, and there's a reason I say
what's the case for sentencing entrapment here? Mr. Cooper appears to have been quite willing and accommodating vis-a-vis Mr. Rauner's request for the crack cocaine.
But, Your Honors, if you look at the sentencing transcripts in which Mr. Rauner was cross-examined, who gave Mr. Rauner the idea of asking for the crack cocaine? It was the officers who were involved in this investigation. As you can see before in the prior dealings, there was rarely ever, if any, dealings of crack cocaine with Mr. Rauner. Mr. Cooper served prison time, was released. It was Mr. Rauner who approached Mr. Cooper on behest of the officers. It was the officers, which came clear during the sentencing hearing in this matter of Mr. Cooper, who told Mr. Rauner, and Mr. Rauner admitted that it was the officers who told him to ask for crack cocaine. Why would they ask for crack cocaine? Because the sentencing for crack cocaine is a lot higher than it is for cocaine. And as Mr. Rauner said, you cook it for me. If you look at the transcripts, it's Mr. Rauner on multiple occasions asking Mr. Cooper to cook it into the hard substance, into crack cocaine. And again, that was on behalf of the agents. And Your Honor, with the Seventh Circuit not acknowledging sentencing entrapment, what we have before us is a situation where the officers who do the investigations, they set the guidelines. The district court's hands are bound by what the guidelines are and what Congress has set the guidelines should be for specific drug quantities and specific drugs. So then their hands are tied. So whose hands are open to decide what kind of penalties a person is going to receive? It's the agents who are doing the investigation, the agents that ask the snitches to go ask for a specific substance, because those agents know, dealing within the federal system, what the guidelines say, what kind of drug quantity gets what kind of sentence. The court's hands are tied. It's the agents who are now making the decisions, not even the government. If the government's not even involved in the initial investigation, it's now the FBI, the DEA, the Chicago Police Department, who is making the decisions, because they know. They are well aware of what kind of sentence an individual will get if he has 1 kilogram of crack cocaine versus 1 kilogram of powder cocaine.
Now, there was some history with Rauner and Cooper, because Rauner also testified that Cooper had been supplying with crack since 1988.
Well, Judge, that
1998, excuse me.
Well, that was contested, though, Judge. And Mr. Rauner at sentencing stated that his dealings with Mr. Cooper had been powder. What took place in the trial court was very different than what took place at the sentencing hearing. If you go back and review the sentencing transcripts, Mr. Rauner says his dealings were with powder cocaine. There's a question of when they met, when they began dealing, and what they were dealing. More of that was brought out during sentencing because of the issue we're going to raise in 2255. We get to that point regarding the effective assistance of counsel. So, Judge, there is no real evidence to show that their prior dealings were crack cocaine. Rather, it was powder cocaine.
But all this evidence was before the district court, and the district court had to make a credibility finding after sentencing.
Well, Judge,
as you said, more information came out. I understand you've got your ineffective assistance of counsel claim.
And, Judge, just to give you an example, the district court, when looking into the credibility of Rauner, even questioned it when it came to the sentencing issue that we raised, whether or not this conspiracy started in 1996, 1997, or 1998. The judge wasn't even sure when it started, when Mr. Rauner said it started in 1996.
But even if there's doubt about whether the conspiracy began within 2 years of Mr. Cooper's 1996 release from prison, What about the government's point that the conspiracy certainly began within 2 years of his release from the 5-month prison term in early 2001?
Just taking that effect, if you looked at Judge Holderman's finding that it started sometime after, at least by 1998, if it had started in 1999, that 5-month prison term may have been eaten up by the conspiracy or the other underlying charges. We may have never have gotten to that issue because it could have been happening during the conspiracy, not after the fact. What probation came back and said is that Mr. Cooper was released in 1996, that after his release in 1996, he entered into this conspiracy. Given that circumstance, yes, then the 1 point for being within 2 years of a past criminal conviction or sentence would count. But if this conspiracy started any time after 2000, that 5-month period would have been eaten up by the conspiracy because he's already involved. It wouldn't have taken place after. I see that my time is up, but there's no other questions. On behalf of Mr. Cooper, we ask that this case be sent back.
Just a minute, because I need to get this straight. Are you saying that there is a dispute that it began within 2 years of his release from the 5-month prison term?
No, Judge, not to that issue, but what I'm saying is...
Judge, if
the conspiracy began even in 2000, we have to go back to look to the underlying offense of what those 5 months were for, determine whether or not that gets eaten up by the conspiracy. That determination would have to be made first before you could say that it was within 2 years after.
Okay, thank you. Mr. McGovern?
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning.
Good morning. May it please the Court. I think the Court has addressed Mr. Cooper's argument that there was an alternative ground for the criminal history point, and that was noted in the government's version as well as the pre-sentence investigation report.
Judge Holderman rely on that alternative ground? I think that's the only question here, isn't it?
Well, I think
he made a statement that isn't entirely clear about what he was relying on.
That's correct. Judge Holderman said the conspiracy began in 1996, 97, or 98. He did not pin down.
He said something about 2001, didn't he?
I think the fact that the defendant did not object to the PSR, nor did the defendant address that issue at the sentencing hearing, I think it can be inferred that the court read the PSR and adopted its findings. There was no objection by the defendant at the sentencing with respect to the issue of whether the defendant was released from custody in May 2001. 1 month before the offenses in this case.
Will that issue go toward the ineffective assistance of counsel that we
may or may not be seen? It may, but I think as the court recognized and as counsel's recognized, that's an issue for another day. The next issue that I'd like to address is Mr. Johnson's argument about Mr. Coleman's testimony. As this court is aware, it is repeatedly recognized that expert testimony on drug trafficking is permissible. The district court in this case recognized this court's case law allowing that testimony. The district court repeatedly cautioned the jury during the testimony that it was free to disregard Mr. Coleman's testimony. And most importantly, under Lipscomb, the primary test is whether the government or the government's witness, in this case Mr. Coleman, specifically referred to the intent or the mental state or the knowledge of the defendant. That did not occur in this case. I think Mr. Coleman's testimony was couched in terms of the typical participant, and the district court repeatedly admonished the jury that Mr. Coleman was talking about the typical participant in a drug deal. Mr. Coleman testified on a number of issues, and one of those issues, which is the primary issue here, is the behavior of couriers at drug deals. And under the Lipscomb and the court's most recent decision on the issue in United States versus Love, it's the government's position that Agent Coleman's testimony was properly admitted.
Mr. McGovern, why wouldn't Mr. Johnson potentially qualify for a minor role reduction if his role in the overall conspiracy was limited to the one transaction at the very conclusion of the conspiracy?
Your Honor, he would not qualify because he played an integral role in the offense. Obviously, his role was very brief. It was within minutes. The actual delivery took seconds, but it was still an integral role in the offense, and that was the delivery of the crack cocaine.
A deliverer would never qualify for a minor role reduction. Is that the government's view?
Well, I think that the case law says that the focus is not what role the person took in a broader conspiracy. It's what role the person actually took in the offensive conduct.
And he was sentenced only on the amount of drugs he actually delivered, isn't that right? He wasn't sentenced on drugs anybody else.
That's correct, Your Honor. In the bag that he delivered was all the drugs that were at issue in this case, and he was sentenced based on that amount. If there are no further questions from the court, I would just ask respectfully that...
Well, let's talk about Mr. McMillan for an instant. What evidence is there that the white bag that he was seen on, that he was seen with, on the afternoon of June 8th was the same bag that Mr. Johnson used to deliver the cocaine that evening?
Your Honor, there is no evidence that it was the same bag, but I think the jury could reasonably infer that a similar-looking bag, a white plastic bag that obviously in everyone's experience you could get at a grocery store, happened to be transported by Mr. Johnson hours later after Mr. McMillan was handling a white plastic bag. There was no direct evidence that it was the exact same bag, but a reasonable inference for the jury to conclude was that it may have been the same bag.
And as to Mr. Cooper, Mr. Cooper's counsel seems to still have some doubt about whether the transcripts were admitted into evidence. You're confident that when we go and examine the record, we will find that Judge Holderman admitted them into evidence?
Your Honor, I believe in our brief we cited two instances where the judge expressly said that the transcripts were admitted into evidence. And based on those comments by the district court, yes, I believe that they were admitted into evidence.
And am I understanding all of this correctly, that Judge Holderman sent the tapes back into the jury room at the start of the deliberations and then waited to send the transcripts until the jury asked for them?
That's correct, Your Honor. Judge Holderman did not send the transcripts back until there was a request by the jury to send the transcripts back. And as you recall from the reading of the transcripts, Judge Holderman repeatedly admonished the jury that the transcripts were merely aids to the tapes and that the tapes were the evidence in the case. Thank you, Your Honor. And again, the government would just ask that the court affirm the convictions and the sentences.
I'm going to give you each a minute.
The government argues that the key inquiry under Lipscomb is whether or not Agent Coleman specifically referred to the intent of the defendant, okay? And I pointed this out previously, but I want to underscore it, okay? That is a relevant consideration, but it's not determinative. The Seventh Circuit has said in Lipscomb that the opinion has to be based on the expert's knowledge of common criminal practices, not on some special knowledge of the defendant's mental processes. Relevant in this regard, though not determinative, is the degree to which the expert refers specifically to the intent of the defendant. So it's a relevant, but it's not a dispositive consideration. Sorry. Is there a question? And then I just wanted to, we were talking about the Fifth Circuit cases before, and we've cited Gutierrez Farias, and in that case, there was a DEA agent who testified that a dealer is only going to select people who know what's going on. And what the Fifth Circuit said about that is that the clear suggestion of the agent's testimony was that because most drivers know there are drugs in their vehicles, defendant must have known too. Although admittedly, the agent did not say the magic words, in my expert opinion, defendant knew the marijuana was in the tires, we believe his testimony amounted to the functional equivalent of such a statement. That's what happened in this case, and the Fifth Circuit did find a 704B violation in Gutierrez Farias. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Turner.
as the government here candidly, I think, admitted, you can't say that that white bag is the same white bag. And even if it's so, on their evidence, Mr. McMillan comes in twirling the bag. There's no almost 2 kilos, which is about 6 pounds or 3 pounds of cocaine in there. The jury found him guilty, and I'll be very candid in my comments, on an irrational basis. There's three guys sitting there at that table. Mr. McMillan is Ray Cooper's brother. That's all a jury needs to hear. There is no rational basis, none, for this conviction of this individual. People may not like him. They may say that he's a bad person. But on the basis of the evidence produced in this case, there is no rational basis. It's unjust and it's dangerous, because what it means is that just because some co-conspirator says someone's name over and over enough times and even says things that are contrary to the laws of nature, contrary to the government's own expert about cooking this cocaine, contrary to all the physical evidence, the person is still found guilty. And that can happen. And we all know it can happen. It's happened lots of times in this state where innocent people have gone to jail. So, and that's what's happened here. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Turner.
Again, Your Honors, on behalf of Mr. Cooper, I ask that the Seventh Circuit take back and give to the district courts the right to sentence defendants, not the agents. It's not the agent's duty to decide what kind of time that a defendant gets. It's the courts. We're asking the Seventh Circuit to recognize sentencing entrapment because it's happening. It's happening because these agents are deciding how much time a person is going to get in jail. And as to the question Your Honor asked about the tapes, it's our position that those tapes, the transcripts, were never entered into evidence, yet they were used during deliberations. Again, we ask that this matter be sent back.
Well, will the record tell us the answer to that question, or is it just he said, he said?
Well, Judge, I think the record will show that the tapes were not admitted. I don't think there's any evidence in the record in this matter to show that the tapes were entered into evidence. Rather, the contrary, that the tapes were not, because the record has to be made. The government needs to make that record to show that those tapes were entered. That record was never made. It's void that these tapes were entered into evidence. The transcripts were entered into evidence. Thank you.
Thank you. Any of you appointed? You were appointed. Well, you have the thanks of the court for a fine job done for your client, as do all of the lawyers, of course, but we're very grateful that you took on this assignment, Mr. Franklin.
Thank you.
And thanks to the government, of course, and the